you. Please be seated.
The court notes that this is the last argument in which Justice Hankinson will be participating with us. We come to the third case, 2179, 6th RMA Partners against Sibley. The court is ready to hear argument from the petitioner.
May it please the court. At the outset, I'd like to make three observations with regard to the facts of this case. First, this is a lawsuit on two promissory notes which matured in March of 1992. Those notes remain unpaid, and despite a statement by the respondent that he did not dispute the debt and realize that the loan had matured. Second, it is important to note that the entity RMA Partners was used as a common name or trade name for the entity called 6th RMA.
Well, let me ask you about that. I mean, you don't dispute that they're two separate legal entities in every way.
They are separate legal entities in the year 1995. Because in December of 1995, Justice O'Neill, the entity called RMA Partners ceased to exist. And after that day, through the years 1996 through today, the name RMA Partners has been used by the entity 6th RMA and its, its sister entities, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, all the way up to 16th RMA Partners, continue to use the name RMA Partners. And I would like to stress to the court at this time that the evidence at trial and as part of the record would show some of the following things to show that the trade name was not just something thought of. The demand letter that was sent in 1994 that was sent to Mr. Sibley before suit was filed was sent on letterhead that said RMA Partners. Secondly, that same letter said that demanded payments that make the payment to RMA Partners, not 6th RMA Partners.
Let me ask you this. Put aside the limitations issue for now. If they are two distinct legal entities, if RMA maintained the suit, got a judgment, became final, time ran for appeal, final judgment. Presumed is still timely. 6th RMA finds this note and says, hey, we own this note, we're going to sue on it. They could still bring suit on that note, and the fact that a judgment had been entered in favor of RMA would not affect 6th RMA's ability to also sue on the note. Right?
I would respectfully disagree.
Why?
First, in any promissory note lawsuit, you must, as the plaintiff, prove that you are the holder of the note. That is why, throughout litigation on promissory notes, there is the requirement that the original promissory note be produced, or there is a problem that plaintiff is going to have. And being in this field for 22 years, I can assure you that has happened. But in this case, the original promissory note was in the courtroom when this case went to trial in August of 2000. So to answer your question, Your Honor, another entity called 6th RMA or anybody else could not come into court because that original note was there and that judgment was there, and that would bar any other claims. I think that's first. Secondly, as has been pointed out by this court, an entity such as 6th RMA may file suit or be sued in its common or trade name, and that's what happened here. That the lawsuit was filed in that common or trade name. So somebody else, again, could not come in and try to claim they have a note or they have a claim because the trade name was used, and at the time the trade name was used, the entity holding that trade name was 6th RMA. And if I may go a little further, the letters that came from an address on Hilton Avenue, whether you were writing RMA or 6th RMA, there was only one address ever used. And also, which will be shown in the record, that when files were sent out of that office in Columbus, Georgia, for lawyers to file suit, again, I believe Exhibit 27 of the evidence, even the referral letters for lawyers says RMA Partners. The word 6th RMA does not appear.
Well, so, but would the argument be different if, let's say that 6th RMA engaged in some illegal collection practices, and a suit is brought against them for their wrongful activity in doing that. Could a plaintiff in that suit say all these entities are one and the same and they're all jointly and severally liable?
Yes, Your Honor, they could. In fact, there could be a claim under the Federal Fair Debt Collection Practices Act because there could be confusion caused by the collecting entity when trying to do that. Now, if RMA is trying to, if RMA or Sixth RMA is trying to collect its own debt, the Federal Act does not apply, but that does not mean that the Texas Debt Collection Act would not apply, which has some of the same provisions about a collector not being throwing out confusing issues and otherwise violating the law. And in this particular case, I'd like the court to know that Mr. Sibley did send a letter pursuant to the Federal Fair Debt Collection Practices Act to our firm and asked us to respond to verify the debt, which was done. And there was no issue or question about who owned the note or any issues raised. The verification of the note did occur and it complied with the law, and no issue was brought for any violation of the Federal Fair Debt Collection Practices Act or the Texas Debt Collections Act in this suit. With regard to the trade name issue, the final point I would like to make in terms of facts is that even the testimony of the RMA representative, Sixth RMA representative, is so to said to us there was no distinction between RMA Partners, an entity that formerly existed, and Sixth RMA. So my second point is the suit was brought in the trade name. The right party was there. The third factual point I would like to bring to the court's attention is that in any lawsuit in Texas, what is important is the parties have notice and they have the ability to obtain evidence and be able to present their arguments to the court. In this case, the respondent was able to do discovery, take depositions, was able to obtain a witness from the original savings and loan in which the loan was signed, that the note was signed, was able to obtain a witness that testified at trial from the RTC, which was trying to collect the note prior to the note being transferred to 6th RMA, and even had testimony from an expert witness, which I'll get over my objection, with regard to the substantive law issues about the case and what was the applicable law there. Thus, there was a real trial on the merits, and a decision was made by the court, the trial court.
Mr. Kozanski, now I'm a little bit confused. I thought this case was fighting over whether or not you probably substituted in the right plaintiff by using the supplemental petition, but your argument here is that the right party was there to begin with, and so it was immaterial about the supplemental petition. You had to, they didn't disprove that you were the owner and holder of the note, and as a result, the Court of Appeals should go ahead and address the rest of the issues in the appeal. Just who are you? RMA Partners, or you're 6th RMA?
Your Honor, we are 6th RMA Partners.
And you're the owner and holder of the note?
Yes, sir. And we did business as RMA Partners. That is how RMA and 6th RMA, pardon me, that is how 6th RMA and all of the other RMA entities communicated to the public and made demands for. That is how the system operated.
And so, is the record going to bear that out? I thought the consistent testimony at the hearing was that these are all separate and unrelated entities.
They are separate partnerships, Your Honor. If I may go just briefly in the background. What happens is the original RMA bought a portfolio of loans and went out to collect them. Apparently, they did well enough that those people who were members of RMA went out and sought other investors to raise more money to buy other loan portfolios. So you have, ultimately, 16 loan portfolios. Each portfolio has some different investors, and it's called 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
But was there any testimony or any documentation showing that RMA was appointed formally or as the agent?
There was no formal designation. Instead, the testimony, undisputed testimony, in which the court can find beginning on page 180 of the reporter's record through 198, that all the collection activity for the RMA entities was done under a common name or trade name, which was RMA Partners. Therefore, the correspondence that went out did not say 6th RMA is making demand on you, or 18th or 14th RMA, it would only say RMA Partners. And that is that evidence is in the record. That were the demand letters that were sent in the course.
So you're saying by practice that's the case, but there's no formal legal relationship between these two.
It certainly was the practice of a formal legal...
I mean, no one could look at any documents or the Secretary of State's office or anything to show that that's the case, other than RMA testifying this is just the way they did things.
That would be correct, Your Honor. To my knowledge, nothing was filed in the Secretary of State's office, but that is how they did business, which we don't think acts as a bar in any way, because an entity may file suit in its common name or its trade name, or be sued in its common name.
But it didn't file a DBA.
No, they did not, Your Honor. And if I'm jumping ahead, I apologize, but I would say that if there was a lack of a certificate of authority filed, then that should have been brought up as a plea and abatement, which was not done in this case. If you're challenging someone's certificate for your authority. One point, there are 2 points I'd like to make.
Before you do that,
sure.
Can I follow up on Judge Enoch's question? If 6 RMA had never been brought into the suit, RMA could not have collected on this note.
Your Honor, I would not agree with that.
But they were not the owner and holder.
They were not. And so if RMA was suing by itself, it was not the owner and holder of the note. It could, if it was designated agent and came in, I'm the agent to collect this note. However, the proper way would be for the entity that owns and holds the note to come into court and prove it.
But again, my question is, if RMA had been in court and said, here's the note, and we're here to collect it, they couldn't have done that.
That's correct, because the endorsement on the note and or the allonge would not show them to be the owner of the note. Consequently, they could not prevail, if that's the fact scenario that happened.
So they were not a proper party.
RMA was not a proper party, agreed. However, our position is that 6th RMA was proper in this lawsuit because it was filed suit under its common name or trade name as allowed by Rule 28 of the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure. My next point has to do with, we try lawsuits on their merits to have a decision based on the merits, and that's exactly what Rule 1 of the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure does provide for. It says that the lawsuits are to be decided under established principles of substantive law, and that's what has occurred in this case. Secondly, with regard to the idea of limitations, I would point out that the test has always been whether or not a party is disadvantaged in getting its evidence or other items. I see that my time is up, and I
thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. John Cowell, argument for the respondent.
Good morning. I'm here on behalf of Mr. Sibley, who is in the courtroom today. I noticed that the court seems to have trouble figuring out who RMA is, who 6 RMA is, who's the real party. And I don't blame you, because if you read their briefs, they can't.
But if you really wanted to know, could have filed a denial. I mean, isn't this a bit of a gotcha?
I don't think I got the question.
Well, I mean, if you had any question about who the entity was or were confused in any way, you could have remedied that.
Plaintiff's first supplemental plea and abatement, defendant's first supplemental plea and abatement and, not supplemental, first amended plea and abatement and amended answer raised all these issues as defendants, that, RMA and 6 RMA aren't the same, that RMA didn't have authority to do business, 6th RMA didn't have authority to do business under the name RMA. That RMA Partners is this LP with a separate legal entity who's charged.
But you only did that after limitations had run.
Well, we did that after they substituted parties, or attempted to substitute parties.
No, but I mean when you answered and said that they weren't.
Right. Well. Yes, when they decided that they were going to switch from RMA Partners to 6th RMA Partners, that's when it happened.
Did the original pleading say RMA partners are also known as Sixth RMA. The chronology of this is a little bugging me. What, the original petition only showed RMA partners versus Sibley?
Correct. RMA partners, LP versus Sibley. After limitation, discovery, so sometime it was discovered that RMA partners, LP, was not the name of the LLC. Sixth RMA partners, LP. After limitations had run, RMA filed their supplemental petition saying RMA partners LP and Sixth RMA partners LP are one and the same, they're the same company, there's no difference between them. Subsequently, they filed changed the style of the case to RMA partners, aka Sixth RMA partners. Subsequently, they filed a second supplemental petition where they.
So the first time that Sixth RMA Partners LP shows up is by way of what document?
Supplemental petition. RMA supplemental petition. Right.
And that's the one that you say was passed. There was some sort of counterclaim filed and then a response to a counterclaim. But the counterclaim was filed against RMA Partners Limited.
What happened was Sibley got the demand letters. He believed that he had an offset based on legal work that he had done for the RTC. He filed a declaratory judgment action against RMA Partners LP, which is the name that was on the demand letters. Prior to being served with that lawsuit, RMA Partners LP filed their own lawsuit against Sibley.
It wasn't clear to me, but in the counterclaim that was filed and the response to the counterclaim, the pleadings continued to list RMA Partners Limited without any reference to Sixth RMA Partners Limited.
Up until the supplemental petition that said RMA Partners, aka Sixth RMA, and the second supplemental petition just referred to that Sixth RMA, aka RMA. Completely lost my place in where I was going.
Is there any jurisprudential reason why you shouldn't be able to use a supplemental answer to correct a misnomer?
Well, not if it's made in response to the last preceding pleading, which is, the rule is clear. It says supplemental petition is used in response to the last preceding pleading, which was not the case here. I believe they have abandon their argument now that the Plowman exception applied. So essentially, we have a rule that's clear and unambiguous, no traps in there. They just didn't read it. They chose to do a supplemental petition instead of an amended petition.
I understand the rule. Can you think of a reason to support the rule? Is it a good rule?
I don't know what to say other than that. I don't know why. The Texas rule says supplemental petition is done this way. The federal rule says supplemental petition can only be used to add new matters that occurred after suit was filed. What I do know is that when you look at the opinions, the courts will allow you to add parties, and the U.S. Supreme Court says you can add a new party as long as it was a party who came into it after complying with the federal rule. And all the Texas courts have said you can add a new party with supplemental petition so long as it's proper use of supplemental petition. If we're going to use supplemental petitions for whatever, if the rule ought to be changed, the court has rulemaking power and it's free to do that. But it's not something the court does through opinions. Even if we don't, if you just decide that the rule is wrong, you don't want to follow it. First of all, they never said in their pleadings that they were substituting a new party. They said it's the same party, which is what they say now, except that, they also said in their second supplemental pleading, they didn't say it was a trade name. They said it was a misnomer, that they just got it wrong. When they try to use Rule 28 here, it contradicts what they said in their pleadings, which was that it was a misnomer. And also, Mr. Trzosnowski testified at trial on this issue, and you know, he said that he was aware that they were different companies. He said that you know, their contention was that 6th RNA came in at the second supplemental petition, and then later said maybe the first supplemental petition too, but never said that, that they were contending that RNA was a trade name or an assumed name that they could sue under.
And it's hard for me. I'm having difficulty when a plaintiff misnames a defendant. The court seems to look at, well, was the right defendant served? Were there enough facts listed in there to indicate that everybody knew what they were talking about and that sort of thing? And it seemed to me the defendant knows the defendant's own identity. I'm not sure that works clearly when the plaintiff gives the wrong name, because the defendant gets served, but the defendant would not necessarily know the identity of the right plaintiff. They just know that this plaintiff is not the one that they think they're obligated to. I'm having a difficult time saying how these things match on the misnomer and misnaming, except you did have some correspondence with L. I mean, you thought you had a counterclaim against RMA Partners Limited, didn't you?
Right. They're the ones who sent the demand letter. That was the name of the demand letter.
And your note showed it was 6th RMA Partners Limited, I guess. Or some...
I believe that RMA actually had the note. It simply had received a letter at one time from the RTC or something.
In this case, you really knew you were litigating over the note, and you really knew it was RMA Partners, basically, that were suing on the note. So, how are you prejudiced?
If the question is... Well, let me say one thing. $90,000 in attorney's fees.
Here's what I'm saying. I'm not sure misnomer really fits here. But on the other hand...
Well, I think it's a misidentification is what it is, which is the wrong party sued. And, you know, the rule is when the wrong party sues, generally, or in a misidentification, what the court said in NSearch is that it when you have the wrong party suing, it's a misidentification. Misidentification generally doesn't relate back for limitations purposes. There's an exception in Continental Southern Lines, which is cited in briefs, where there were related companies who held themselves out to the public and caused the confusion, and so the court was willing to forgive the misidentification there. But if you look at Matthews Rocking v. Smith, when you don't have that that relationship and that holding out, then the misidentification exception, the exception in Continental Southern Lines, doesn't apply. It's an equitable remedy based essentially on sort of an equitable estoppel.
Question about this RMA's second supplemental petition was filed 7-6-1999 and makes clear that 6th RMA Partners is the plaintiff, and then trial was held sometime after that.
Well, first of all, I would disagree with that characterization. It says, continues to say that 6th RMA Partners LP is RMA Partners LP, the same company.
We just assume that we read it that 6th RMA Partners has made an appearance on 7-6-1999, and it should be clear to the defendant that they're a plaintiff in this cause of action. Trial was held some months later. if this was the first time that the defendant knew who that Sixth RMA Partners was asserting that they were a plaintiff, how was the defendant prejudiced in defending the substance of the suit at trial some months later?
I can't tell you whether he was prejudiced in defending the substance of the suit.
Well, let me ask you if you agree, because my first question was, if RMA, statute of limitations aside, if RMA had sued and gotten a judgment, and it was later determined that they were the wrong party, could 6RMA then later sue and also get a judgment?
Well, I'm not an expert in banking law, so I can't comment on
that. Well, I think this is the reason behind the rules, is to keep someone from being sued twice on the same obligation. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, there are rules, but they've got to have a meaning behind them. And
as I said, I'm not an expert on banking law. I don't have anything to dispute that with, but what we're looking at here is requesting a general rule that doesn't just apply.
I guess what I'm saying is the potential prejudice, it seems these rules are designed to prevent, would be that type of situation, that you don't have a judgment taken against you by one party, and another party comes in who is actually the proper party and gets another judgment against you.
I don't disagree with that. What I will say on that is that, there wasn't anything at trial that indicated that...
Not in this case.
In this case, that, some other party couldn't come back later.
What happened to the offset claim at the trial court? Was that tried?
It was raised in summary judgment, and it was tried, and the court denied summary judgment. It was simply summary judgment motion.
The court denied the offset?
Denied the, yes.
But her testimony on it?
Yes, there was. And we didn't appeal that.
The Court of Appeals decision said that statute of limitations ran on March 1st, 1998, but that defendant's position? That there was a 6-year statute of limitations that ran in 1998?
Our position was 4 years. There's a Texas 4-year statute of limitations, and then there's the federal 6-year one. I believe that our position at trial was that it was the 4-year statute of limitations that applied. Mr. Sidwood said that either one, it would have been barred under either one. I'm not quite sure of the chronology there. I would like to point out a couple things on the waiver arguments. First of all, is for the Rule 93 verified pleadings. There's nothing that was required to be verified that isn't in the record, that wasn't raised in Sibley's amended answer. I don't think there's any genuine issue there. The rule only requires that it be verified if they don't appear in record. I mean, they could have objected and kept the evidence out, but they didn't. It's in. It's there on the record. Rule 90, special exceptions issue. They're issued. All the issues have been raised a year before trial. Everything is covered in there. Issue number 3, thinking about the name of the parties. The issues were brought to the judge's attention before trial, or not before trial, but rather before the judgment was signed, which is always required under the rule. I don't think we have anything there either. Unless there are any other questions, that's...
Any other questions? Thank you, Counselor.
Thank you.
if A brings suit claiming it is doing business as B, or if A brings suit claiming it is also known as B, and it's proved at trial that A is not doing business as B, or A is not also known as B, then is B properly before the court?
No, because the court has said that trial has proven that A did not do business as B, or alternatively, A was not the same as B. The evidence was at trial, and then in that situation the court presented, that would dispose of the matter. Because A did not do business as B, that was not the evidence. Unlike the evidence here, it is overwhelming. If any time a Sixth RMA attempted to collect a debt, it used a letterhead that said RMA partner.
So are you claiming then that this is an evidentiary review, that we say that the trial court abused its discretion by not finding that B was also known as A as a matter of law? I mean, if the evidence is that B is not also known as A as alleged, then how could B properly be before the court?
Because it's sued in his common name, Your Honor. This case is almost identical to the Chilkowitz versus Heisen case, where Dr. Heisen was sued individually. And the stationery that Dr. Heisen used to evaluate patients and things said only Martin Heisen, MD. It did not say Martin Heisen, MD, Professional Association. Yet the correct or properly named defendant in that case would have been Martin Heisen, MD, Professional Association. And this court, in that opinion in 1998, written by Justice Owen, found that the proper party was sued when the entity was sued in its name, its common trade name. The limitations stopped.
Let me ask, Mr. Kazan.
Yes.
I'm sorry to interrupt the question. But the Court of Appeals decided this case based on the supplemental petition might not being sufficient to substitute in the party. The trial court granted a summary judgment in your client's favor, didn't it?
No, sir. There was no summary judgment, Your Honor. There was a trial.
A trial on the merits.
Correct.
And during the trial on the merits, did you bring forth proof that you were, that LLP was the common name for Sixth at RMA Partners?
Yes, Your Honor. Please look at the record beginning on page 180 through page 198.
Then why did the Court of Appeals only address the question of whether or not you properly supplemented your pleadings for that?
They were in error. I could not understand the reasoning of the court, if I may say, because we sued in the name of the common name, which didn't cause a problem, which caused no special exception to be filed. And if I may, I would like to direct the court's attention to the...
Up here in this court, do you bring a point of error on the Court of Appeals? Do you bring a point of error on the Court of Appeals decision that you proved at trial as a matter of law that Sixth RMA Partners was doing business as RMA Partners LP?
No, Your Honor, we're saying that we
up here,
had, we had sufficient pleadings, they had sufficient notice, and they did not preserve their error with regard to that issue.
They didn't preserve error that you failed to prove that you were, that Sixth RMA was doing business as RMA Partners.
No, Your Honor, I apologize. I must have misspoke. My point was that if you're going to look at the rules of procedure, they should be, and they're going to be construed strictly to both parties. If they're saying that our pleading, our supplemental pleading, was not sufficient and they want to rely on Rule 69, then I would direct ask the court to consider that a strict construction be applied to Rule 90, in which if there's any defect as to form or substance, is to be brought to the attention of the court in writing. That's Rule 90. And a supplemental petition which improperly brings into a suit either a new party or a new cause of action still must be objected to. In our briefing, we presented the court the Hawkins case, where the Dallas Court of Appeals found that the plaintiff tried to bring in a new cause of action through a supplemental petition, and that was not correct. But they would not reverse the judgment in favor of the plaintiff because the defendant failed to file a special exception under Rule 90. And there is a long history of Texas law requiring that if someone feels that there's been an improper party being added or an improper cause of action being added, you need to file that special exception.
But you still have to prove your entitlement to judgment in the first instance that 6th RMA Partners was doing business as RMA Partners LLP. Do you bring a point of error in this court asking this court to reverse the CA because you proved 6th RMA Partners was doing business as RMA Partners Limited as a matter of law in the trial court?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that would be our position.
I'm asking, is that a point in your brief?
No, we didn't put it in the brief that way, but we did argue the idea that a common name was there. We said there are three reasons why the statute of limitations should not apply. One is the misnomer analysis, that the correct party is there, but has simply been misnamed. The Womack opinion addresses that issue. Secondly, we have misidentification, where you have two similarly named parties, but the wrong one is there. Never in this case was the wrong party there. If you wanted to find out about 6th RMA, you sent correspondence, you needed to contact the people on Hilton Avenue in Columbus, Georgia, and that's the only place you would go, and that's where Mr. Sibley went with his correspondence, and that's where this case came from. I would please ask the court to look at the SMS case cited in our briefing, because it discusses both the idea of misnomer and misidentification and facts that are identical to this, save and except for that we filed a supplemental petition, whereas in the SMS case, there was two entities, SMS 1 and SMS 2, trying to collect on promissory notes. I apologize, my time is up.
Let me ask you, what do we do with the statute that says unless you filed an assumed name certificate, you can't sue or be sued or assume that?
I'm sorry.
What do we do about the statute that deals with assumed name that says you've got to file a certificate?
Well, my response would be, Your Honor, if we didn't do that, then the proper cause of action, and it's in our reply brief, the authorities say that you must file a plea and abatement to address that, and they did not file a plea and abatement on that issue, or get a hearing on that plea and abatement. They did file some pleas called plea and abatement, but not on that issue.
What was the supplemental petition that first named RMA, a.k.a. 6th RMA, filed beyond the limitations period?
I think it was, Your Honor, but may I add this, that the original petition that was filed had attached to it the promissory notes with the allonge, which or endorsement, that said it was 6th RMA. So that there, and also in 1996, they sent out interrogatories asking about 6th RMA if they could be responsible.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Here's the argument for the third case. The cases on the docket are submitted. The marshal will adjourn.
All right.